We're going to be sort of giving you a preview for the first three chapters. And, well, Father, I should just let you take over now.
One shouldn't be daunted by this book. It's not a, it's not intended to be a systematic book of philosophy or of apologetics. It, Chesterton says in various places, it is more a set of mental pictures than a series of deductions.
I think that's true. He sort of he has a common theme, but he says something like that, just like a little dart. Then he goes on another sentence, he says something like that. They're sort of loosely connected, and yet they are connected.
Yeah, you have to kind of absorb them one after the other. And afterwards, a mosaic begins to appear before your eyes. He says, for example, later on in the book, not so much a diagram of a doctrine as some pictures of a point of view. Or in another place, I put these things not in their mature logical sequence, but as they come.
That's right.
So this is what he realized at the end of the crisis that we mentioned at the at the last program. And perhaps just out of this first chapter, a few sentences to to state what he's aiming at. This at least seems to me the main problem for philosophers. Once again, this is the philosopher who is the common man. Everyone has a right to have a view of the universe, not just the men in the academies. This seems to me to be the main problem for philosophers and is, in a manner, the main problem of this book. How can we contrive to be at once astonished at the world and yet at home in it? How can this queer cosmic town, with its many-legged citizens, with its monstrous and ancient lamps, the stars, how can this world give us at once the fascination of a strange town and the comfort and honor of being our own town? We have a need for that mixture of the familiar and the unfamiliar which Christendom has rightly named romance. By that he doesn't just mean romance between sexes. That's an aspect of it. But he means the romance of our life as a kind of adventure, a kind of surprise. We don't know what's going to happen. And the more you get into the faith, that becomes even more significant. You're living from one day to the next. We need so to view the world as to combine an idea of wonder and an idea of welcome. We need to be happy in this wonderland without once being merely comfortable. It is this achievement of my creed that I shall chiefly pursue in these pages. So what he's attempting to get us started with is to freshen up our appreciation of reality, once again of the universe. And many present this book as a book of Christian apologetics. What he's trying to do is just, this is just a witty new presentation of Christianity and of Catholicism, ultimately. But even that's not getting to the heart of the matter. He is attempting to get us back into contact with our common sense approach to reality, because it is in that reality that the mysteries of Christianity occur. Our Lord became a man, and he walked the earth. And if we don't know what a man is and what the earth is, what the universe is that he came into first, we can't understand the supernatural mystery, because it presupposes that. And so he's attempting to awaken us to wonder at that world. He says, for example, it is one thing to describe an interview with a gorgon or a griffin, a creature who does not exist. It is another thing to discover that the rhinoceros does exist and then take pleasure in the fact that he looks as if he didn't.
That
is, things like this that we take for granted, that really are marvelous. And one of the themes he'll return to throughout this book and through all of his books, and something we should be trying to return to, is to look at things long enough so that we actually see them. He says you have to look at something often 100 times before you see it once. That's the first chapter, really. He calls it Introduction in Defense of Everything Else. As he says himself, he was only moved to write this book when somebody had criticized his criticisms of those who were saying all these false modern things about the world, these new philosophies that were coming up and attempting to throw overboard all of our old traditions and points of view. he wrote a book against that called Heretics. And he was pointing the finger at them, saying, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, reducing all of their positions to a kind of absurdity, and very skillfully done. Then somebody came out and said, well, this is very fine of Chesterton to tell us what's wrong with our philosophies, but why doesn't he tell us what his is? And she said, all right. So he wrote Orthodoxy. And this first chapter is simply apologizing, really, that he's not writing a systematic book. It's just a series of mental pictures that attempts to convey to the entire century the salvation that he found out of his own mental trap. And he said that mental trap that he just about slipped into which so many of us slip into. I can even remember as a young boy, thinking seriously about this myself, that possibly the world really is just a dream of mine. I mean, if you start thinking like that, and you go far enough, nobody can refute you.
Mm-hmm.
Because the refutation can be a part of your dream, too.
Right.
You know, you've gotten yourself into a trap, and he spends the next two chapters to define the two ways in which we can get into that trap. And once we're in that trap, when you first hear the gospel, or when you review your catechism, that catechism can only make sense, and that gospel can only be addressed to you if you are somehow already situated in the world in a realistic way. And these two traps are traps that take you away from it. The first one is called the maniac. We mentioned that in the last...
Okay, I just give you a quote from this. We touched on this on our first show, but it says, "The madman is not the man who has lost his reason. The madman is the man who has lost everything except his reason."
Right, right.
Would you explain?
Right. Reason is it's a tool. It is a tool that takes us from a principle that we already have to conclusions that we don't yet have. It's a means. In fact, it's very helpful to compare us with the angels on this point, because the angels are also intelligent beings like we are, but they do not have reason. It may sound strange to say that. The angels are creatures without reason.
They don't have to go through the process.
They don't have to go through the process, right. They see everything the way we see first principles. And we as human beings, the only thing we see in that intuitive way are the first principles that he's defending in this book. But reason then starts there and moves to new conclusions about it. But reason cannot establish those first principles.
Right.
And this is the error that men, particularly the philosopher René Descartes and Immanuel Kant and several others too, who are trying very hard to work out a new first principle that's perfectly clear and lucid and manageable. And Chesterton's message is the first principle is the universe. It's the reality that God has created, and it is not manageable. You can't get your mind over it or around it. It's always something you're going to be astonished at. It transcends you. It's beyond you. And just perhaps one little overview regarding all of his work. Only by accepting first that the world around us transcends our knowledge can we then use our reason to transcend the world and discover that somebody must have made that world, and work our way beyond the world, transcendent to God, who is transcendent.
That's so important, because you said this. So many attempts are trying to reduce the world to one's preconceived notion of what the world should be, or at least as they understand it,
right,
from their own limited resources, not to see there's something far beyond what we can understand.
And this is the basic, as you said, the basic error of the maniac or of the the modern philosopher who shares this position, although he doesn't do it in a mad way, of course. He has not lost his reason, but he has lost everything except his reason. And the poet, on the other hand, and this is something else that is very strong in Chesterton, is that even before reason can function sanely, one must first have a poetic appreciation of reality. One must learn how to sing a song, how to dance, jig, or how to write a poem. It doesn't have to be a good poem. It doesn't have to be a beautiful song. It has to be a nice song. It doesn't have to be a talented song. He says in one of his famous sayings, "If anything is worth doing, it's worth doing badly." We shouldn't just have the virtuosos and the professional musicians whose records we have, but everybody should learn to play some kind of a little instrument, even if you're not very good at it. Because that draws something out of you. You rise to a poetic participation in reality that keeps you moored, keeps you contact with reality when you go into reason.
So God has made us more than rational animals.
More than just rational animals. He says about poetry, for example, "Poetry is sane because it floats easily on an infinite sea. Reason seeks to cross the infinite sea and so make it finite. The result is mental exhaustion. To accept everything is an exercise." The poet can accept everything. "To understand everything is a strain. The poet only desires exaltation and expansion, a world to stretch himself in, like every child, like every ordinary man. The poet only asks to get his head into the heavens. It is the logician who seeks to get the heavens into his head. And it is his head that splits." when you try to use your reason and logic to figure out the world and figure out the principles, you get very strained, and you get wrinkled forehead, and if you follow your principles all the way through, you go crazy. And there are people that did do that, actually went mad by trying to found the first principle. I don't want to mention names, mm-hmm. but some very prominent philosophers of the last century did end up in an asylum.
I think this is why the Holy Father has addressed himself in his work on reconciliation and penance. I mean, he talked about the Tower of Babel and how man held himself out as God and set God apart, and it was self. They're on a road for self-destruction, and then how he said at Fatima. We talked about this on another program, but the next Synod of Bishops, when he was in Fatima in 1982, to thank Our Lady for saving his life, the next Synod of the Bishops would be on the Fatima message, and then the Synod was on reconciliation and penance. So that's the essence of consecration, really. And
yes,
so he's really talking to us.
And the Holy Father really is a kindred spirit with Chesterton, because his poetry has already been published. I mean, he loves to sing, and mm-hmm. he's a very, very poetic man. He's,
yes.
And yet a very capable philosopher, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, he can sit down and write poetic prose that will give you some beads of sweat to mm-hmm. work through it. But he also could lean back and sing a song.
Yes,
and this is the
right.
point of poetry. Mm-hmm. And the maniac is the man who somehow has not gotten that. And in order to restore it to him, the trouble with using reason in this way is that you can't reason someone out of it either.
Mm-hmm.
Because just like someone who says everything is my dream, if you come up and say, I'm not a dream, he says, well, yes, you're a part of my dream. Or somebody says, I am Jesus Christ. And you come up to them and say, yes, but everybody denies your divinity. You say, oh, they denied Christ too. Anyway, mm-hmm. he's got a perfect answer to everything. And to get him out of that, a man cannot think himself out of mental evil. For it is actually the organ of thought that has become diseased, ungovernable, and as it were independent. He can only be saved by will or faith. Mm. The moment his mere reason moves, it moves in the old circular rut. He will go round and round his logical circle, just as a man in a third-class carriage on the inner circle, now this is in London, will go round and round the inner circle unless he performs the voluntary, vigorous, and mystical act of getting out at Gower Street. You know, the way to get off a merry-go-round or is to
stop.
Step off. Mm-hmm. Likewise, decision is the whole business here. A door must be shut forever. Every remedy is a desperate remedy. Every cure is a miraculous cure. Curing a madman is not arguing with a philosopher, it is casting out a devil.
Hmm.
And it's not seriously, of course, but
yeah.
People who have this need a good encounter with reality, a cold mm-hmm. shower, mm-hmm. or a stub toe, or something that brings you back in contact with the world. And then you can start again with the world, with reality.
Bringing this now into Christianity, this approach that Chesterton is really attacking, is trying to reduce Christianity to something manageable, something we can understand, as opposed to what Christ has revealed and nature has already revealed before.
As a matter of fact, his other very famous book called The Everlasting Man,
mm-hmm.
which would be worthy of a program in itself, he has two parts to that. One part is on man, mm-hmm. the other part is on Christ, the creature called man. He says you just have to look at man. You realize either a god has fallen from the skies, or one of the animals has gone off his rocker. He said, but you cannot logically argue your way to man from the animal kingdom,
mm-hmm.
as the theory of evolution would like to do sometimes. You can't argue him. You can't argue his existence. He's just there, and he's marvelous, mm-hmm. and he's strange, and he's unpredictable. And Christ, likewise, in the world of religion, our Lord. You cannot argue your way to him from any of the other religions. You can't even argue your way to him perfectly from the Old Testament. The Old Testament points to him, but it points to him in an obscure kind of way. And when mm-hmm. he finally came, they said, wow,
yes.
it does fulfill the prophecies, but that isn't quite what we expected.
Exactly.
Right.
And Chesterton's full of this realization that the world itself is already a surprise. It is already a gift.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a logical conclusion. It's a sudden gift. And he's attempting to free us of this modern habit of trying to reason our way to everything. He says, reason used without root, I mean reason without this root of our first encounter with reality, is reason in the void. The man who begins to think without the proper first principles goes mad. He begins to think at the wrong end. And for the rest of these pages, we have to try and discover what is the right end.